Hello, it's me, Sam Dunnewald. I'm here before the show to tell you that I am kickstarting my first standalone in-print RPG, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's a John Wick-inspired game of bloody revenge inside a tight-knit clique of professional assassins. It's a one-shot capsule game, box set, deck builder, and it's the end result of 3 years of interviews and ideation on all things game design right here on Dice Exploder. If you like the show, if you like how I think about game design, I think you're really going to love this game. I really just want you to know about it. I want you to play it. And you can follow the Kickstarter page right now at a link in the show notes. You can back the game starting May 5th. That's it. Thanks so much for listening, as always. I hope you check out the game. Here's Dice Exploder. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop mechanic and try and chisel away at the stone all around it. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host today is Austin Walker. And boy, does Austin do a lot of cool shit, so I'm going to let him walk you through all of it.
Hey, everybody. I am Austin Walker. I am the lead designer and writer on Realis, a science fantasy tabletop role-playing game that is on Kickstarter right now. It's being published by Possible Worlds Games, which is to say Tyler Crumrine, who has been an incredible help for that. I'm also the host of Friends at the Table, an actual play podcast, in its 11th year. We are currently doing an ongoing campaign of Fabula Ultima. I'm also the co-host of A More Civilized Age, a Star Wars podcast, where we're currently working through the 4K fan releases of the original Star Wars trilogy. And I am also the co-host of Shelved by Genre, where we are currently reading through the Lord of the Rings books by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Austin is here because he's currently got a game on Kickstarter, Realis. What is Realis? It's a place, a cursed orbital sphere of 1,000 mystical moons filled with magic and impossible technology. And of course, it's also a game, one of diceless storytelling, where characters deploy sentences, which are rewritten over the course of their saga. Realis sentences are the kind of mechanic that made me want to start Dice Exploder in the first place. They're things like, I always kill my foe, or when I have the proper tools, I always heal my patient's wounds. And these are just true statements while you're playing the game, until they conflict with each other, and then the juice really starts flowing. It's such a delicious mechanic, and I wanted to hear from Austin all about where it came from, what influenced his design. And he came back with another mechanic for us to talk about: weak, strong, and regular moves from Dream Askew, Dream Apart. I've recently covered on Dice Exploder both setting elements and lures from Dream Askew, Dream Apart, but today we're really getting into what maybe I should have started with, the real meat of the game, its diceless token economy. And talking to Austin, it's so easy to see how he got from here to Realis later on. So let's get into it. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. And here is Austin Walker with weak, strong, and regular moves from Dream Askew, Dream Apart. Austin Walker, thanks for being here on Dice Exploder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we are here today to talk about Dream Askew, Dream Apart, weak, regular, strong moves, like the token
That's
economy
right.
of this game.
Yeah.
Last week we talked about lures, or I did anyway, with the tabletop book club folks. And I think this is going to be a nice like sequel episode to that, to kind of like really get into the details there. Maybe we did these in the wrong order, but whatever. like tell me about overall first, like what's Dream Askew, Dream Apart, in your words, and then what's up with this particular mechanic in it?
Great ask. Dream Askew, Dream Apart are a pair of games by Avery Alder and Benjamin Rosenbaum. I believe Dream Askew sells itself as like a queer community after the apocalypse, or maybe it's actually a queer struggle after the apocalypse. And then Benjamin Rosenbaum's Dream Apart is a Jewish fantasy in the Shtetl or something like that, drawing on Jewish folklore and Jewish history. And the two of them are diceless tabletop role-playing games where players navigate the needs of their own characters and of the community, the threats that those communities face. And I think mechanically moves a step, takes some of the big ideas from the sort of PBTA era of games and the kind of the designs that the Bakers kind of initiated into great fame and influence over the 2010s. And then like shifts them away from dice-based play and really underscores the sort of like mechanical structure of storytelling in a way that I think is really fascinating to me. Core to that is the system of moves and tokens. Obviously, moves are something that Apocalypse World, I think, probably brought to the forefront, though I don't know that I would say it started them. But it definitely helped really crystallize that formation in, I think, a lot of people's minds. And I'm sure we'll get into reading the actual mechanics here. But the core thing here is, like, it moved from you roll some dice to see if you do the thing you want to do to you can do the thing you want to do if you're in the right position, if you have the token for it. And sometimes the thing you want to do is not positive because it'll get you a token so that you can then do the big thing you want to do later at some point, right?
Yeah, love incentivizing people to get themselves in trouble, at least for the kind of role-playing that I'm doing, yeah. So I want to go back and like read some of the text from the book actually out loud here. I found this first paragraph in particular really interesting. So we have the section header, making moves, and then it says, whenever your character takes action, that's you making a move. Moves are how the story unfolds. By default, a lot of the moves you make are take action, leaving yourself vulnerable. But anytime you're called upon to act, you can look at your list of moves and choose a different one to inspire your narration. Already, I was like, Avery's saying literally every time I take action as my character that's making a move. Like, that is such a fundamental, like, reframing of what moves are from Apocalypse World, right? And in this way that I think makes it much more helpful. It's much clearer, too, in a certain way, where, like, there are plenty of things that I'm doing while playing a role-playing game that aren't my character taking action. And saying, no, anytime your character is taking action, that's you making a move. That's your, like, turn, almost. Like, that feels helpful.
Right. I think that they're doing slightly different things, which is to say, I think that it makes sense for Apocalypse World for moves to be discrete things when you take particular types of action. There's something genre-wise happening that's a little different. Notably that, like, I think once you say, okay, you're going to pick up the dice to roll, there's uncertainty happening. And so in Apocalypse World, the reason those have to be distinct is that's when something uncertain might happen. Whereas I think in Dream Askew, Dream Apart, those are definitely things that you're doing. And once you have that, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It's all moves, right? It's all actions. That means that even if what you say is, I lean against the wall and give someone a look, that means it's as important as if you look at your sheet and say, I'm doing the regular move of take, maybe that move is take action, leaving myself vulnerable, right? And I think that is allowed in a sense because it's a diceless game. I want to be clear when I was like, I think they're doing two different things. That wasn't me dismissing the kind of underlying thing that you were getting at. But I do want to make sure that we don't fall into the trap of saying, well, clearly this is just an evolution that leaves the other one behind. They're doing different things, I think, on purpose. And I would tell different stories with both of those things, if that makes sense.
Well, it's using the same term of move for like two different categories of thing, because like in Apocalypse World, some moves are diceless, right? Like not every, all the basic moves are typically like at that thing that you're talking about, but there are plenty of moves that are just like, oh, you did the thing. Here's the thing that happens. And like in Apocalypse World, you're not always making a move when your character takes action, but in Dream Askew, Dream Apart, you are. Like there is still that division in Apocalypse World between what am I doing out of character and what am I doing in character? Like what am I doing at the table that is taking action as my character and what's not? And so it's just reframing the definition. And like that, I don't think one is better than the other. I think both of these games are fantastic, right? But
it also does two other things, which is like one, to go back to the thing you said, it means that when we talk about what's happening at the table, because you kind of described it as being like, it's sort of like you're taking a turn. It helps us realize that sometimes you don't have to pick up the dice or say, I'm using my move in order to like have been in the spotlight for a little while, right? And so it's a way to ensure that there is the sort of care at the table around time and attention and, hey, we haven't really seen the iris, whoever's playing the iris a lot in the last, you know, 10 minutes, 12 minutes. What's going on over there? You know, what's up with the Stitcher, et cetera, right? And so like, I think that also ends up being a good way to manage that part of play that doesn't necessarily, when you're just thinking, well, I haven't rolled dice in a while, that doesn't mean you haven't been doing something. You haven't been taking actions. You haven't been doing moves. And I think that in comparison with Apocalypse World, it's very easy to like dominate an Apocalypse World, you know, session for an hour without having rolled any dice and kind of be like, well, it's not like, you know, somebody else got the last dice roll. And I'm not saying that's like that's not an evil thing. We all have stumbled into that at various capacities. But I do think that like being like, no, listen, every time you take an action, you're making a move, does help you think about the structure and flow of play a little bit.
You started a while back, we're digging into one of the specific moves that's called out in the text here, and I want to dig into that a little bit more too, the take action, leaving yourself vulnerable, is, I believe, the only move that all the playbooks share, and is, like, you know, it's a standard move, so it doesn't engage in this token economy. We should explicitly lay out the token economy, right?
Yeah, like, let's explain this for sure. There are playbooks. There are playbooks in this game, right? I guess even though it's a GM-less game, and even though you also get to play the environment and the threats and the other factions in the world, everybody has a character who is theirs.
Yeah, I've liked this term protagonist character that's come up in more games recently, in like GMless games.
As I'm in editing for Reals, which is not a GMless game, I've been like, is protagonist character still something useful to me?
Yeah, maybe because player character implies the GM's not a player anyway. So
I agree.
So anyway, every playbook has a set of weak moves, and the weak moves are typically some variation on get yourself into trouble. And it has a set of strong moves, and the strong moves are some variation on get yourself out of trouble or like show off how you're cool. And a set of standard moves that are just kind of like, here's some other things you might be doing, and they don't engage with the token economy. And I really want to talk about the standard moves later, but like for now, that's what we need to know, right? One of those standard moves that I believe is the only move that all the playbooks have is take action, leaving yourself vulnerable. And I love what you were saying earlier about the, like, when you describe your character leaning against a wall, the game says that's a move. So you must be doing one of the things on your sheet. You're probably not engaging with a strong move or a weak move. So probably what you're doing is one of those basic moves. And all the other ones are more specific. So probably you're taking action, leaving yourself vulnerable. Why are you vulnerable right now? Like, it's underlying that implicit question every single time, which then does, like, leans into the thing that makes this economy or this token economy so exciting, makes this game so exciting to me, is that sort of attention to story structure. The fact that this game, through its token economy, and there's a sidebar in the game that I'll read in a second about this, like, really leans into, we are here playing with that, like, typical story structure. We are, like, using this system to mirror and facilitate the regular beats of a narrative that we are used to.
Totally. And the thing that you said of, like, you know, use this leaning on the wall example that we keep coming back to, that might be taking action and leaving yourself vulnerable. But by asking, wait, what move is that? You might come to realize that actually it is threaten or coerce someone. Oh, actually, I'm threatening or coercing someone in this moment. I'm leaning against the wall with my arms crossed. And by my body language, they know it's a threat. And it's like, oh, that's not, I didn't mean that at first, but now I'm exploring the space of what I mean. And so it gets to something that I think role-playing games are really good at. You know, we talk about different types of media having different capacities, different affordances, depending on who you're talking to, right? And, you know, the novel is really good at interiority, right? Because you can use this character, all this text to explore the interiority of a character. A film, you know, can do a lot visually that in a split second that would take the written word a lot of time to describe. But also maybe by having all that time to describe, you can do da-da-da-da-da, right? You get how this works. One of the things that role-playing games can do, but don't always do, is play through the ambiguity of action and drama of that ambiguity, because you can slow down play and go, like, wait, what's that mean? What were you trying to communicate with that, right? So it's like a form of interiority, but it's also a form of authorship that I think is, we don't get it written about as clearly as this sometimes. You know what I mean? There are lots of games, including, I think Realis is not as good at this as this game is at being like, when you do a thing, there's ambiguity in it. Let's talk through what that is. And in this game, the way that that's done is, hey, it's a move. So when you lean against the wall, are you taking action, leaving yourself vulnerable? Because if so, that means someone might take advantage of that vulnerability. Or are you confessing something and seeking forgiveness? Are you, et cetera, right? And I think that that is a really powerful component of the game. I will say, we are wrong. There is another move that basically everybody has, but not exactly. There's one variation. There's a strong move, which is a move that you have to spend a token to use. And that move is get out of harm's way, which is the same for everybody, except for the whatever the leader character is, who has get yourself or your gang out of harm's way. The tiger. It's the tiger. And so that, I think, is really interesting, because there are things that are the same, but with, like, minor differences, which is also one of the ways I think this game works, is, like, you know, there's no action that you could do that you couldn't find an appropriate move for. It's just that what those readings are change from class to class. So, like, in other words, the lean against the wall maneuver that we keep coming back to might be different for someone who's playing the sort of the hawker, right, than for the tiger or the arrival or the torch, right? The fact that you have different moves available to you, sometimes with only slight differences, means that all of your actions, even when you describe the same physical action, might result in a different move. I think that's a really cool way to conceptualize playbooks or classes or archetypes or whatever you, protagonists, you know what I mean? Whatever you're thinking about there.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to give Avery Elder, who I believe wrote a lot of this text, like an opportunity to chime back in here. So we read the like first paragraph of what's up with moves, but a lot of this stuff we'll have covered already, but I want to just like read it out loud because I think it's great. So the next paragraph is, making a move means taking the prompt and running with it, letting it guide what you say next and how you play your character. The move might point toward an outcome, but know that what happens next may still surprise you. You don't always need to announce the move by name, but sometimes it can be helpful to do so because it will help ensure that all the players are on the same page. I think that the thing that I pull out of there that I find really interesting is the way that even though this is a diceless game, this text is still, I think, very correctly pointing out that like there's still uncertainty every time you make a move. And that uncertainty, I believe, comes from you don't know how this thing is going to crash into the other players at the table. Like whatever you say next, you don't know what other people are thinking exactly. You don't know what they're going to say. And like that's where the uncertainty in the game still comes from. And I think that's such an underappreciated part of like diceless games. Like people are so like, I wanted to put randomness in the game without appreciating that it's not randomness, but that uncertainty that is still really, really present in this game and games like it.
It's still really open-ended, right? You know, there is still, and that comes from the ambiguity of language, which, you know, to her credit, Avery here is like, hey, listen, part of the value of speaking the name of a move out loud is it helps narrow that ambiguity, right? Because I've played this game, and there have definitely been times when I say, oh, I lean against the wall, and someone goes, oh, you know, Austin's character's trying to threaten me. And I have to be like, oh, actually, I'm taking action, leaving myself vulnerable. And so like, we can all get onto the same page of, oh, the camera actually frames this in such a way that like makes me look vulnerable. You know, like it's shooting down at me. Or I say like my character, there's a slump in my character's shoulders that you see that, you know, makes you think, oh, actually this is kind of like, this isn't tough character mode. This is like, whoo, I'm leaning back and like I'm looking kind of out of it, you know, and being able to clarify through the moves that then are like, that's clear, right? That's crisp in a way that if I just describe the action, might not be. And it's okay to leave that ambiguity sometimes. And there's other times where it's really important that we get down to it. And so it's kind of just like having it's called a playbook, right? We don't think about playbooks like sports playbooks very often, but that's what it is.
Like the bakers have said that's where it came from. Like that's why they called them playbooks.
That's
right?
Why they called them that. Yeah. So when you think about it that way, if you think about like a football play, you're like, oh, I know where I'm supposed to stand in this play. I know what route I'm supposed to run or where I'm supposed to pass the ball or what sort of, you know, block I'm supposed to provide or whatever sport it is, right, you know? That is part of the value of having these moves written out. And it's not just to lose comfort. You know, there's a version of this game that you can imagine that has, like, I'm acting without a token, I'm acting with a token, and I'm acting to gain a token. And those are the only three moves. And, you know, I've seen some people over the years kind of, like, play in that space. And I think that there's some value in that because of the incredible ambiguity there, that if you're at the right table with the right people, with the right inspirations and the right tonal match, you can really do a lot with that. But the moves provide something, which is the opportunity to narrow ambiguity when you take action, to surprise even yourself. Because there are so many times I'm playing this game where I say I'm doing a thing and I look down at my sheet and go, oh, wait, what move am I making? Oh, I'm making that move. Whoa, where's that going to take us? And that is, I think, kind of the strength of it for sure. It's also like, this is why this was such an influence on Realis, was I went, oh, you know, for people who don't know, Realis has these sentences that are not that dissimilar from moves here that are all like, I always do blank, right? And like, it is exactly that sort of, I want to narrow the possibility space. I want to narrow the ambiguity by making a really clear, crisp claim about what it is I am able to do in this moment. That comes from here as much as anywhere else.
We're going to get a lot more into Realis later, I think. But the thing I want to like underline for me, the like listing off here's a bunch of specific moves that you can make. The thing that it does is it gives me like scaffolding and specificity to like zero in on like this game's genre and fiction so that I don't have to deal with the like blue sky problem of being like, what am I supposed to do now? You know, like the thing I've been thinking about this a lot with games lately that like I did this like 2 hour long episode on Triangle Agency where I like talked about this a bunch, but like what I want from games is a curated experience. If I'm going to just go make stuff up with my friends, like I can do that. Right. And like, I like that games are interactive. I like the kind of experience that I get when I play games, but fundamentally I'm still there for the same reason that I'm going to the theater, right? Like I want a director or a designer or a writer or whoever to take me by the hand and like show me their thing, you know, like I don't want them to just sort of say, figure it out, good luck, here's a 20-sided die or like whatever the thing, here's some tokens, like, you know, have fun. Like we have that at home. Like I want to show up and be told, okay, one of the things that you can do is stare deeply into someone's eyes, right? Like one of the things that you should be doing are like this specific set of things. And to me, that's the purpose of rules of role-playing games in the first place, as opposed to just like co-writing, you know, is to show up and to be handed this incredible toolbox from people.
Yeah, I think that there's the act of designing and playing games for me is such a process of figuring out how deep down that line I want to walk before it's not as fun for me anymore. And how far away from that line I want to walk before it starts becoming really fun for me. Because like you said, you could just do co-writing. I like co-writing. It's pretty good. I've been running an actual play podcast for 11 years. There's a little bit of co-writing in that. Mostly we're playing games, though. And I'm glad we're mostly playing games and not just co-writing. It does give me something different. At the same time, I've hit points where I've been like, ooh, there's too much of the game here right now. The game has overwritten us or has denied us the opportunity to fill in the blanks. And I don't think that there's like a universal formula for getting that right for any individual player or any individual game. And maybe let me be more particular or more specific here, which is to say a game like Dream Askew takes place in a post-apocalypse. Avery does a great job of setting up some key structures of what that apocalypse is, that, you know, it hasn't arrived equally across all social strata. There's some people who are more on the outside and more on the inside, things like that, the environmental capacity towards it, etc. In that way, it's kind of like Apocalypse World, which is like, oh, yeah, you know, apocalypse stuff is happening, right? But it doesn't say there was a gas shortage. It doesn't say, oh, well, those are the, you know, take something from another piece of post-apocalyptic media in the last few years. In Death Stranding, there are like former Amazon delivery guys who have become bandits. It doesn't say, oh, there are those, that's a group of people that exists in the world. It's not very particular about groups, factions, reasons for the apocalypse, ways to stop things from happening. If something supernatural or super scientific exists in the world, it leaves a lot of that space up for the players. There's a lot of empty space for players to fill in that way. And then also, I should say, mechanics can do this too, right? Games that have ammunition are saying something different about the world than games that don't, right? Like if you're playing an action-focused game and you're playing a game where you're counting your ammo or you're like managing your inventory tightly. You know, I tell a story a lot about playing a game of Torchbearer 11 years ago or 12 years ago where we had this encounter where we got into a dungeon. I'll do the very quick version. We got into a dungeon. We got to a big trunk that was like surrounded by a sleeping guards. We opened the trunk and there was a huge expensive carpet that we needed to empty all of, we'd like dump all of our food rations into the trunk and then take the carpet and carry it out with us because that was the only way we could fit it in. It was the only thing we could drop that was low value, which was food. And we like just had a blast imagining all of these orcs waking up and being like, hey, where did our carpet go? And what's up with all this food, you know? And that game produces that. It's interested in, the mechanics help produce a genre space, right? Produce a genre simulation. There's lots of great games that do this, many of which don't realize that they're doing this. There are lots of bad games that do this, that don't understand that they're doing this because the mechanics help shape the way that stories get told, right? And so I feel like for me, there are times when a game has given me too much of that, either mechanically or simply by like digging into the book and it like it you know, it takes over my own imagination. And I think for me, something like Dream Askew really hits the middle really tightly, really flavorful, clear invitation to a narrative space, to a genre space, to a style of play that's interested in thematics, particular thematics. This is not an post-apocalyptic game that is interested in tactical gunfight decisions. It's interested in violence. Violence is in this game for sure, but it doesn't fill in all of the gaps that I'm super excited about filling out with my friends, you know? And I think that's part of what appeals to me so much, is like hitting that real, that sweet spot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, something that I think helps a lot there, and that I also see a lot in Realis when we get to that eventually, is just how much the like writing being good is like helpful in making this thing fucking work. Like it's like the fact that the poetry like of the like moves in this, like the couple of like just the word choice, just the like tiny little individual pieces of writing in this, the pick list options on character sheets, like every part of this game, and especially the moves that you're using over and over again, all of that writing, I think, is it like it being so high quality is in part doing that, riding that line you were talking about, right? Where it is being like super evocative and specific while also like asking the question, so what does this mean exactly? Like what is going on here? Like with this particular thing, it's inviting you to come in and like take this one given in the world and then expand around it to blow it up, to like interrogate the world and your story and fill in the blanks around it.
Yeah, you know, I think about something like the Iris, which is a character who has these kind of like psychic touches. Like, okay, well, if someone's playing the Iris, that means the psychic maelstrom exists, right? But you then get to decide, what does the world psychic maelstrom, what has it told you? What's it like? What's your experience of it like? And that's to say nothing of when you get into the other side of this game. And you start playing as not just the protagonist characters, also the kind of like world, the setting elements, I think is.
Yeah, I did a whole episode on setting elements a couple months ago, too.
Perfect. So we don't have to get into that. But, you know, that is that's part of the component of the way moves work, is also that like they're in relation to setting elements, right?
Yeah, yeah. So. And the setting elements themselves also have moves, I believe. They don't play into the token economy here in the same way, but they're continuing the language of moves in how you are intended to think about them, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't gain or spend tokens, and they don't innately give tokens to the other two protagonists, right? To player characters.
Yeah. I got a question for you. So there's this thing where like the token economy, it implies a certain story structure, right? And we've kind of been talking about that a little bit. And I think it implies a pretty traditional like Western story structure, right? Of like, you get into trouble and then you get out of trouble and oh, you get into trouble again and you go around and you do the thing. And like, obviously that works really well. Like, you know,
there's a good reason for modeling a game economy around it, which is that's a style of story that most of your players, especially if you're in the Anglosphere, are going to be very used to and very familiar with. And you can count on them to intuitively understand that, even if they could never put it into words.
Yeah. But also sometimes I show up and I'm like, I don't want to do that. Like, or sometimes I like want to push against that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think this game like certainly leaves space for that. Like, look, my favorite thing to do in Belonging Outside Belonging games like Dream Askew and Dream Apart here is to show up and play for the high score of tokens, to just like hit weak move after weak move after weak move and like see how dig a hole I can get into before something breaks. And like, I like games in part because they allow you that ability to push on them in a way that like has to be more extra textual in like another medium.
Yeah,
that like I like showing up and being like, where are the edges of this? What are the like systematic like assumptions here that are being made, and like do we have to follow those? But I'm curious to hear from you, like, we're modeling this traditional structure, is that good? Like, I mean, I any given game, sure, that's, it's fine to do that. I've made a lot of games that do that, but like how do you feel about that here?
I think that I don't think that not modeling it will save us.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Yeah. And so I think not modeling it is really fascinating, is really interesting. I think that there are games that are interested in other types of loops in narrative. A game that I have like really strong positive feelings to, even though we ended up moving away from it, is, and there are bits of it that I think I'm critical of too, to be clear, but The Veil, the kind of post-cyberpunk game, has this system of emotional spikes and emotional. I don't know if you've played this game before, but
no, I haven't. But I'm playing Under Hollow Hills right now, which is already sounding very similar. Yeah, okay, yeah. It's very much less about consequence and more about like every interaction changes one of the parties or both of the parties involved. And like, what does that mean rather than conflict exactly?
Interesting. That's really cool. I think that like part of, for me as a player and as a storyteller, I'm really embedded in that particular structure. And there's lots of substructures inside of that structure, just to be clear, right? There is not like one, you know, anybody who goes down this road of modeling story structure and reading about the models of story structure might like start with the Campbellian hero's journey stuff and be like, well, that's the model. But even inside of the subcategory of people who want to catalog and analyze story structure in the Western mode, that is very give and take, the stuff that we were just talking about, we'll find that you actually end up needing to have like a bunch of different story maps, right? And so there's a lot of space there. What there doesn't tend to be is sort of like the unresolved conflict or the conflict that resolves itself without a direct confrontation, or, you know, there are elements of that that don't find their way into a lot of this version of mapping stories in the kind of Western canon, especially. But I, you know, the thing that you just described, though, is you can play this game that way. And I think that's the thing that it makes games really interesting. This is the classic thing of like, do you have to run right to play Super Mario Brothers, right? Or are you playing it by standing in place and jumping until the clock runs out, the timer runs out and you die? Is that a valid way of playing it? And like, yeah, of course it's a valid way of playing it. It just means you're going to see that's the whole game for you then, right? And so I think that space of improvisation lets you push back against some of those pressures, but it does mean that you may end up with a different play experience than everybody else who's playing it, which, you know, I don't know, there's a limit to that. I guess the coming back to your core question is like, I think that it is a really difficult and a really fun challenge to build a system that pushes against those strictures. I think achieving it would be remarkable, partly because you don't have to achieve it just for yourself, as any designer has come to learn as they put things in the world. You have to achieve it for players who are going to be coming in with their own ideas about what a story looks like. And so it's really hard to get them on board if they haven't already gone through the sort of like pedagogical work of learning what are the other story structures in the world, you know? So again, I'm not dismissing that as a goal, but I am cautious about saying like, well, Dream Askew is limited because it can only do what genre fiction has been doing for 6,000 years, you know?
100%.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think most of the games that are like succeeding at doing something different tend to not be trying to tell stories in the first place, sure. Like a lot of world building games, right? Like, I'm sorry, did you say Street Magic or sure. You know, stuff like that?
That's a great thing to think about, right? Because when you eliminate the protagonist as the perspective character, when you divide the player from a singular goal or their character or something, you then immediately are in this other space, right? For sure. For sure.
The other thing that I was thinking about as you were talking was Wander Home, which is based on this same token economy, but also explicitly trying to do a different model of conflict, even with this same set of mechanics, right? Where like your loop can be describe the scenery and then help someone and then describe some more scenery and then help someone like you get, or whatever the thing is, right?
Yeah. And you know what else actually fits this? Warhammer 40,000. Truly,
yeah.
Any hard tactics game that, you know, Cyberpunk 2020's Friday Night Firefight rules, they don't care about the narrative structure endemic in Western literature. They don't care. They care about, are 17 bullets going to hit you in the torso? Roll 30 dice to fight. That's not how Cyberpunk works. That's how Shadowrun works. But, you know, like, there's like the sort of double bind of the story game, right? Which is like, oh, wow, let's just get closer to narrative structures that we're all really familiar with. And finally, let's just tell the types of stories that we've been chasing in all of these, like, dice-heavy, crunchy games. And that's awesome. And also, now we have a different gravity to contend with, right? And we might lose the thing that is never going to happen in Dream Askew is that, like, someone kicks down the door and with no one at the table deciding this explicitly, guns someone down because that's what the dice told us, right? Someone makes that decision in this game. And that's one of the great powerful things of this game is that when something really violent and terrible, or just striking and terrible, or big, right? So when something shocks the world, someone has come up with that idea at the table. And they may have stumbled into the idea, but someone has voiced it because it's popped into their heads and voiced it. But it isn't a game where the dice are going to surprise you in that same way, right?
That's what I was going to say, is that it's like it's a strength and a limitation of the game, right? That like someone is having the idea, someone is offering that up. And so we can pull back from it if we need to more easily because we're in conversation the whole time. But also the dice aren't going to inject that element of surprise into the game in the same way either, right? It has to be someone who is willing to step up and say, what if they just got gunned down here?
100%. Or, you know, very telling that I jumped to that. I'm thinking of a particular Friends of the Table example there for people who are like, why is Austin always talking about people getting gunned down? But, like, that's a thing that happened in one of our seasons. It was like, oh, my God, like, I didn't expect this to just happen like this. And it changed the kind of trajectory of the final act of that season in some ways.
I do also think that Dream Askew, like Apocalypse World, is a game that is really interested in violence. And it is not interested in that in like a let's roll some dice and do some tactics way, but in the like consequences and the costs and the benefits of the appropriate times for violence, you know, all of that.
Hi, I'm Maia, and this is Maia's Game Room, a narrative actual play anthology featuring short-form, story-driven TTRPGs. Each season tells a new story using a different rules-light system brought to life with sound design, editing, and emotional-rich roleplay. So, if you love cinematic storytelling and character-driven drama, come check out Season 1, set in the haunting world of the Electric State RPG. Just search Maia's Game Room wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Dice Exploder is sponsored by Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. And these minis come in a variety of materials, including bronze, color standees, and color plastic options, or download model files for your minis and 3D print their unique designs right in your own home. Hero Forge also has custom printed dice where they'll stick your favorite mini floating inside a die or put that mini on a keychain. Hero Forge custom acrylic keychains are printed at the same scale as the rest of Hero Forge minis and arrive already attached to a high quality zinc alloy lobster clasp so you can take your favorite character wherever you go. Hero Forge is constantly expanding its catalog of customization options, adding new parts every week, so check back in and see what you've missed. Visit HeroForge.com to start designing your custom miniature and dice today.
This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Die Meta Dungeon. Die Meta Dungeon is a campaign-length, dungeon-based adventure for the Die RPG that is also a crawl through 60 years of tabletop RPG history. In Die Meta Dungeon, your characters will enter a massive dungeon that grows deeper and more dangerous as more people succumb to the honeyed allure of role-playing games. Dungeon crawl your way through every era of gaming, from the 1970s to the present day, one decade per dungeon level. Survive to the end, and you might learn something. For the first time in the Die RPG, player characters will get to return to the real world between levels of the dungeon, trying to juggle their real-life problems, and maybe even apply some of the important things they've learned about themselves in the dungeon, before being drawn inexorably back into the meta dungeon. It's a classic fantasy mega dungeon campaign with a postmodern twist, and at least 6 months of sessions baked into it. Die Meta Dungeon is on BackerKit through April 2026. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Orbital Blues Month. 1 month, 6 creators, an entire outlaw galaxy to explore. Orbital Blues is an RPG of sad space cowboys where your crew of desperate and downtrodden outlaws travel across a music-infused space western universe filled with retro-future technology plagued by heartbreak and the haunting shadow of the blues. And through the end of April on BackerKit, 6 creators are all running projects that expand the Orbital Blues universe.
Check out Outlaws and Corporations from Soul Muppet Publishing, a book filled with NPCs, adventures, and setting inspiration. Formula Infinity from Plus One EXP, a high-octane space racing adventure complete with bespoke mechanics for racing. Or A Fistful of Stars from Stations, an interwoven series of adventures set on an interstellar train line. Or any three other projects. Each project also comes with a soundtrack from Behold, which you're listening to part of right now, and which you can get as a limited edition cassette tape when you back multiple projects. Orbital Blues Month through the end of April on BackerKit. Check it out.
I want to move us towards talking about Realis a little bit. So Realis is a sick-ass game. I've read the Ashcan. I really love it. I can't wait to get my hands on the full thing because I feel like the thing that the Ashcan was missing was the what I hope is 120 pages of like stuff at the end of it, like sentences that are already written, you know?
More than that, my friend.
Thank God.
I actually don't know if it's – I don't know the page count yet because the layout is not done, so I shouldn't say that. But it is – I will give you the numbers. It's 55 playable classes.
Oh, so we can get straight into this. Is the meme I've been doing recently is like, what I want is games that have at the back of the book 55 myths, 55 swords, 55 whatever, 155. Right.
So the middle of the book is 55 classes. Those are playable classes. Those have four sentences each. Realis. I give like the high level pitch?
We're getting way into it way too quickly. Let's do the high level thing.
Realis is a science fantasy game. I said this before. It's really deeply influenced by stuff like Book of the New Sun, by Berserk, maybe more than anything. In fact, the very first Realis sentence is actually a thing that happens very early on in Berserk, which I found recently. I'll read it to you by the end of this episode, I promise you. That's like where it comes from. It's a world of 1,000 moons that are orbiting a big, weird blue planet called Realis. There is a dead or dying or cursed sun that is smaller than that planet above this kind of sphere of moons. There's a void that's like kind of rapacious and starving and trying to eat the moons that are low to it. And you play people in that world. There are kingdoms in that world. There are, you know, monopolistic corporations. There are, you know, you could do the Incal here, but you could do Berserk here, right? Like it's anywhere on that kind of science fiction to fantasy, dark fantasy, especially space, you can do it there. Characters are made up of primarily a collection of sentences. Those sentences say very basic things like, I always cure my patient, or I always kill my foe. Those sentences have a rank, a sort of level of reality that they are. They all start for player characters at rank zero. When something is uncertain, you declare your means, which is normally one of these class sentences. You say, you know, someone's trying to hurt your friend. You go, well, I always kill my foe. I kill that guy. And so to stop something, to change the world, you have to act. When you act, there's the opportunity that someone might try to counteract you. Maybe the person who's trying to kill your friend has their own sentence, which is like, I always wield a distinct and ornate weapon, right? Those two things come into conflict. And if they're both the same rank of reality, the tie goes to the defender. The tie goes to the counteractor, the person who's trying to stop whatever the thing happening is. I know this example is kind of weird because I started with the person trying to hurt your friend. So maybe I should have – maybe that's the actual actor in that scenario, right? And so you were dueling, whatever. You know what I mean. If you fail, you know, when you act, you declare a big dramatic intent, not just – I'm doing the thing in my sentence, but I'm trying to do something, right? Not just I kill my foe, but I'm trying to impress everyone who's watching, or I'm trying to like ingratiate myself to the person who I'm saving, whatever that looks like. And then if you fail, if you succeed, you get your dramatic intent, you describe what happens. If you fail, if the other person has beaten you, if their rank is higher or equal to yours and they're countering you, you mark your sentence. After you've marked it three times, you can realize it. You can level it up. It becomes a plus one sentence. But it also gains a new qualification that limits it. I always kill my foe at night. I always kill my foe at a one-on-one duel. I always cure my patient when I'm in the safety of my operating room. I always cure my patient when I have all of my tools with me, whatever that looks like. You then do that that's the game, right? There are a bunch of other types of sentences. There are bonds between characters. The moons themselves have sentences that both the players in the band of players can use and that the GM can use. Factions have sentences that only the GM can use. And factions also have NPCs, which have their own sentences, which also rank up, realize over the course of play. Eventually, sentences reach rank four, but instead of reaching rank four, they actually go back down to rank zero. They retire. So once I always killed my foes, you know, or I used to always cure my patients, etc. That's Realis in a nutshell, right? There's a bunch of extra stuff there. There's items called ephemera that have temporary sentences that you can use. There's all sorts of other kind of mechanics in there. But, like, that's the heart of it. And there are 55 classes. That's where we were.
Yeah, that's where we were, yeah. So it's like fucking, the book is like full of shit, of sentences and ideas and all this kind of stuff, right?
55 classes, 150 NPC classes that are spread out over 30 factions, give or take, 29 factions, right? There's 20 moons. Moons all start with six sentences. There's a ton of that. There's over 100 illustrations in the book, right? Every class has its own illustration from, I don't know, 17 different artists, I think. So yeah, there is material in the book. And what you want to do is, you talked about like going to the movies before, right? Like the world is in the book. You know, there's also some like world building writing in the book. One of the big challenges has actually been how much do I say in the book versus how much do I leave out? Because one of the things that the book's fictional authors, the word rights, have said is, this is our Realis. Yours might look different, right? I find that one of the most fun things people have or do with Realis is make their own stuff, because writing sentences is really fun. And so it was important to me to be very clear in the book that, hey, there's been a lot of versions of our Thousand Moon weird space system. What's yours look like? You know, here's ours, and we're going to give you detail on ours, but you can make your own stuff that looks very different than ours. It just happens to be that it will be run by the same underlying engine, which means it has certain particularities, right? So
yeah. So I want to talk about the connection between Realis and Dream Askew here, because I think, like, already just hearing that initial pitch, it is so obvious where a lot of the influences come from, right? It's a diceless game. It's not a token economy exactly, although there's a token in the game, but it doesn't work in the same sort of exchange rate kind of situation.
We pulled the tokens out. See, we reduced it down to one token.
Yeah.
It was like one of the big things that fixed the game at one point. So
incredible. Yeah. But I also think, like, another piece, the biggest maybe influence that I see here is that, like, poetics layer that I was talking about before, the, like, importance of word choice and almost the, like, writing of the game, whether it is coming from the text of the game, or as you were saying, like coming from the players themselves, because the players themselves are the ones who are realizing the sentences, who are then like limiting the sentences in a certain way. Like when you play this game and you change your character, you are going to be the one who is like contributing writing to that change, right? Yes. Like that layer feels essential to Dream Askew in the way, and Dream Apart the way I was talking about it before, but even more so to Realis.
Yeah, in some ways, maybe the actual touchstone for realization is reading for the first time years and years ago the how do you make your own moves part of Apocalypse World.
Advanced fuckery.
Right, towards the back of that.
Totally.
Advanced fuckery, right, exactly. Because cracking that open in my own head in whatever year, the early 2010s, I was like, oh, they're giving players a grammar to make their own stuff with. Once you understand the format a move takes, and this is, for me, part of why Apocalypse World became Apocalypse World, right? It's one of the ways that it took over that this kind of little corner of the hobby was, oh, there's so much magic in giving people the tools to make their own stuff. And so for me, part of the thing that I wanted to do with Realis was encourage players to do that as a natural part of play, not as advanced fuckery, as just when I level up, I'm making my own move. Whether I don't call them moves, right? They're called sentences. It's called realization. That's like what the fiction of the world demands. But like,
but they're Dream Askew moves, right? Like they are
Dream Askew moves, right? Yeah. Exactly, right, exactly. In fact, one of them is very clearly every class in Realis basically has a weak move, right? The difference being that I don't insist that it's a weak move. You could theoretically use Dream Askew moves in this way also, right? So totally. I don't want to say that that's like locked, right? But like, I explicitly have moves that are meant to get you into trouble in the same way that Realis, or in the same way that Dream Askew's weak moves are meant to get you into trouble, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So like, you know, the Berserker who I already talked about, because that's like the first class in the book, has I Always Kill My Foe, but they also have I Always Hurt Those Close to Me. Now, you could use that very positively, obviously.
I'm immediately saying like, hey, you killed that guy, but your friend got hurt in the process, right? Like
exactly, that's, right? Yeah. The duelist says, I always accept a challenger oh, well, that's a problem. Some people you should not accept a challenge from, you know? And so there's stuff like that, that's super close to the weak move system. But even beyond that, yes, they are meant to be, I always move my body in striking ways. There's a character class that no one has seen yet that is like one of my favorites. It's like, I always remember what happened back then. To me, that's a Dream Askew move. 100%. You know what I mean? And that is, or I always know the best version of a story to tell, right? I don't get there without Dream Askew at all, right? Because Dream Askew recognizes that those are moves, that remembering something is as important in a certain type of story as swinging a sword is or as picking a lock is, you know? And not remembering something in the, like, I remember the formula to the alchemy, you know, potion we're trying to make, but also I remember what happened, you know? I remember the details. I remember what you did. When everything was in chaos, I saw what you did, you know?
And I can stand up in the crowd and tell everyone about it. Or I can threaten you with it in a back room or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are the dramatic intents, right? That's the which I don't think I get to. And here's the real trick of this. Is I was very lucky to work with Avery for a couple of years, like 18 months, on a video game that will never come out, unfortunately. Mm. But Avery like cracked the narrative systems of that game for the team. And part of the process of that and part of the joy of getting to work with her was seeing her pedagogy in action, explaining the difference between different types of kind of conflict resolution, right? Explaining that you can have outcome resolution that is about, did you succeed at the verb you were trying to do? Did the task go forward? Did you succeed at the task? Or did you succeed at the outcome? What's that question when you roll the dice or when you enter into a conflict? And I don't think I get to dramatic intents without talking through some of that stuff with Avery and with that team, which that very weirdly, the game is being published by Possible Worlds Games, but previously I'd been working at a company called Possibility Space. And there's something in my own brain that twists them up sometimes, even though they're very different experiences. So,
any other sort of like direct influence between, you know, Dream Askew, Dream Apart and Realis that you want to call out?
I do think we talked about the importance of taking violence seriously, which I think is weird in Realis because I have, you know, dozens of classes that are very much tied to doing violence, which is not something that is like identified by their way of doing violence, right? It's playing in dark fantasy. It's playing in science fiction and science fantasy that can sometimes be high adventure and sometimes be kind of like brutal, almost dungeon crawling at times. But the key for me is like, when it happens big. This is not really a game about doing 5 HP of damage to somebody, right? It's a game where once someone is being hurt, they're being hurt. And you can get into that. Again, the Berserker is the only class that has I always kill my foe, right? But I think that's indicative of like violence isn't a little thing in Realis. Actions are big, and violence is a particular type of action that is extremely big. And it doesn't mean that you can only play a game where hurting someone or killing someone feels bad or something. You know, I think you can really play a game, and I've played a version of the game where you're having kind of swashbuckling adventure, but the stakes are always right there nibbling, right? So I think that's another huge one for me. But yeah, I think the core of it really is this kind of like, there's a kind of a three jumps, right? The place that this game starts is this image I just linked you, which is from, I think, volume 3 of Berserk. I think that that's right, where Puck, this little fairy, is picking up this strange egg thing. I'm sure there's nothing wrong with that. That has like a mouth and teeth and a nose on it, and it's flying away. He's like flying away from this big gooey tentacle monster who's going insect. And then Puck, the little fairy, goes hee hee hee. Yeah. When it comes to making a getaway, I'm the one with the advantage, fathead. That is the first Realis sentence. I saw that and I went, oh, I have played so many things inspired by Berserk. None of them have hit this thing. When the fairy is in trouble, he always gets away. That's true about who he is. What if there was a game about true statements like that? And so the two big touchstones I had immediately were Dream Askew and then Instincts from Burning Wheel, right? Which is maybe the other core thing here. But the jump from that comic panel to those two things, and then really to moves, realizing like, oh, it's not just that Puck says, when I'm in trouble, I get away, which is the kind of Burning Wheel instinct. It's that it starts at, I always get away from trouble. Maybe later it could become this other thing. And then really it's like, well, what's it mean that Puck always gets away from trouble? Ooh, is it good for everybody around him that he always gets away from trouble? Are there times where it would be good if he was like able to stick around and help, you know? And that stuff that comes from thinking like, ooh, is this a weak move or a normal move or a strong move? And then going like, well, what if I have that flexibility? What if it's just the move? What if it's just the sentence? And then I try through the text of the game to lead people to thinking about playing them as weak and strong moves, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one day I'll be doing an episode on this show about Rialis, and the thing we'll be talking about is that sort of like chiseling down of identity that it looks like the game is largely about, and that I think I've heard you talk about in other interviews. But
I think I've talked about that before. What did I, subtractive design, subtractive progression, something like that is what I think I called it.
Yeah. Because what it feels like the classic metaphor of the playbook or the class or whatever you want to call it is like set in front of you and it's a block of granite. And then like by playing, you carve the statue out of it of who your person is. Right. And that feels like something that Dream Askew and other games that I have seen are not doing. Right. Like this feels like taking technology from those places and remixing it a little bit in order to produce like that kind of result and make something about that.
Well, you know, part of the appeal of Dream Askew is that it's, and you've written this in the notes for this recording, actually, we just didn't talk about it, is that like part of its goal was to be a really good one-shot game, a game you could play at the cafe, a game you could play at the bar, a game you could play with very little prep, and that isn't necessarily tilted towards campaign play. And I think that that kicks ass.
Yeah, totally.
I also like to play campaign-based games. And I will say even something like all of the PBTA games, not all of, but most of the ones that I've played, they have really solid progression mechanics. But the progression has rarely made me go, you know, when I'm running a game, when I'm running a Blaze in the Dark game, when I'm running a Forge in the Dark game, or running a PBTA game, when someone takes a new move or an upgrade, I will often ask if I'm the GM or offer if I'm the player, how did I get this? How did you get this? Like, what happened that led you to this development? But that requires me to enter the text and enter the play with that intentionality in mind. And generally it feels kind of flat, you know, like generally what happens is someone has a new move and then they use it in a cool dramatic way, but there's not like conversation about where it came from. You know, games don't insist on that certainly. And so I find that like I have always wanted a game to say, well, how did it get like that? And also to open up the space for like, well, what if it got like that, but a little different, you know? So I think I appreciate that you've identified that as like the core thing that one of the core things that Rialis is doing, that chiseling away, because that was a real important thing for me as someone who loves a campaign game, but also loves there to be as many vectors for storytelling and characterization as possible, right? When you level up, why is that not a key part of characterization? Oh my God, everything I've ever done to change myself is complex and weird and reflects some life experience. Sometimes I've experienced that I don't know, but someone outside looking in, like a therapist or a partner or a friend, might have access to. And we as storytellers happen to be people from the outside looking into our characters. And so we can frame that, you know? Ooh, what's this realization look like? And there's even a system in the game that lets you realize a sentence. A thing we didn't mention is like if you lose one of those conflicts and you were the actor, your sentence gets countered. You can't use it again for the rest of the scene, right? In a way, that's drawing on another very traditional Western storytelling thing, which is like, if you show the archer shooting the dragon and the arrows are bouncing off of its skin, well, guess what? We're not going to keep showing that in this sequence. We get it. The arrows don't penetrate the dragon's scales. There has to be some other solution here. We have to go to that. So I've countered that. But when you realize a sentence, when it levels up like that, you get to use it again, even if it's been countered, right? So it's like, oh, but actually, I now have the sentence, my arrows always pierce the skin, and then you've added of a dragon instead of like of my foes, right? And that I think is one of the really cool things about the game that is trying to give you that sort of like, oh, when you level up in a game, it's supposed to feel like a cool thing and an interesting thing is happening for who you are. Because in that moment, if that's the thing that you've leveled up, if you've gone to my arrows always pierce the skin of a dragon, guess what? They don't penetrate the skin of a human anymore. They don't penetrate the skin of a goblin anymore. You've limited yourself in this way, you know? So I think that to me is like that's the juice in Realis, is that is tightening. Again, coming back to Dream Askew, it's games with that lean on language in this way. Well, you described it as poetic language before, and I'm not saying that it's a superlative for me.
I am. I'm the one who's saying it's a superlative for you. Yeah.
I'm saying there's a category of language, right? Language that leans into things like ambiguity, lets you play with narrowing and widening that ambiguity in ways that then produce meaning. And I find, you know, if you're out there and you're going to play Realis, my number one tip for you is not to preemptively narrow the meaning before the sentence gets realized. I see a lot of people who play it and go, oh, I have some sort of like magical sentence. I'm going to narrow it down to a very particular vision of what magic is. Leave it open. Leave it open until the game makes you narrow it down, because that's, to me, part of the juice of realization. And it's one of the things that I wanted a progression system to feel like.
It feels like the like melancholy of paying a cost, of like giving something up.
Yes.
You know, like that's yep. What I haven't gotten the chance to play it yet, but like that is what I get from reading the text and imagining it.
Sometimes it feels awesome because you're like, oh my God, I have the key to the door. Like, the dragon has a +1 defensive scales. I could level up my sword to +2 and then pierce the scales, right? That feels like you're the coolest person in the room. And then the next time
you need to fight a goblin.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, well, I just can't do that anymore. I can do other things. Suddenly you're looking at your sentence, I always hurt those close to me. And I go, wait a second. If you can get me close to the goblins, I can hurt them because they'll be close to me. Right. And that's like, oh, shit, the rest of my sentences also shift in the way I read them when I've changed the other ones by realization, you know. And again, all of that to me is in Dream Askew, except for the progression part. In Dream Askew, your weak moves will shift as your game goes on, because you'll realize that, like, oh, my God, like at the beginning of the session, I was reading all of these moves in one particular way. But under this new circumstance, I have come to realize actually that, like, the most powerful thing I can do in this moment is lose in some important way, right? I should take a hit in some important way. Dream Askew, when it produces those moments, you described the kind of progression in Realis as melancholy, but Dream Askew hits melancholy better than any game I've ever played. And I love it for that, as someone who is kind of a sad sack.
Yeah, yeah. Austin, thanks so much. I almost said Realis. Thanks for coming on Dice Exploder. But, you know,
that's me,
yeah,
Realis.
Yeah. Realis, Austin Walker, thanks for being on Dice Exploder.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
Thanks again, Austin, for being here. Run, don't walk the Kickstarter and back Realis today. This game is just so exciting to me. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder, and you can find my games at sdonnewald.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our ad music is Lily Pants by my boy, Travis Tesmer. M. Acosta edited this episode. Thanks, M, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.